Welcome to another episode of Records Revisited Podcast dedicated to the magic of music. I'm your DJ, MC, host on the East Coast, and Ben Montgomery. Joining me is the man, the myth, the lyrical interpretation legend. Here's my co-host from the left coast, Wayne Fugate.
Hola, Benjamin.
Also joining us as a repeat revisitor, you might remember him from episodes about the Kinks and also the album Van Gogh from the Beat Farmers. He's one of our Patreon revisitors. Welcome back, Phil Berg.
Good evening.
And last but not least for this episode, we have a special guest. He's been a part of the band, The Farmers. We're going to talk about that, as well as The Penetrators and The Jacks. I think we're going to talk about all sorts of his musical journey. Please welcome to the podcast, Chris Sullivan.
Hey, well, thanks for having me, fellas. The district attorney told me if I did this, it would take care of all those parking tickets. So I appreciate making that square with us here.
Absolutely. So so we're going to be doing a little bit different format than our usual format. Anybody seen the Adam Sandler movie, The Wedding Singer?
Yeah.
All right. So there's a part where Billy Idol is on the plane with Adam's character, Robbie Hart. He's getting ready to play a song over the intercom, and Billy announces what's going to happen, and he says, because we let our first class passengers basically do anything they want. So that's pretty much the case with this episode. Phil is one of our loyal first class Patreon revisitors who gets to do basically anything he wants, and he wanted to have his episode as a hang with Chris. So we're doing a little bit different today. And we're just going to talk about Chris's career, talk about, you know, whatever musical roads that we get taken down. So there cool. We go.
Cool. I don't know if you want me to drive or go along for the ride, but I got a lot of stories and most of them are true.
There you go. Well, we start out all of our episodes with the all important question. So, I'm going to start with Wayne. So what t-shirt are you wearing, Wayne?
Oh, I'm wearing my Records Revisited Music Master shirt.
Okay. Love it. All right. Phil, how about you? What t-shirt are you wearing?
A couple of years ago, I was taken to a concert. Loverboy, Are You a Speedwagon and Styx here in Chula Vista. I'm wearing that. The one thing I got to say about Are You a Speedwagon, in high school back in the 80s, I wasn't a fan. Just because of one song. And then when I came on and played, I was like, wow, I got much more respect for that whole band. You know, so it's the second time I saw Styx, I saw Loverboy, and Loverboy still does it.
Yeah. All right.
And if I can pitch in, at first it scared me sitting next to Phil with those three bands on his shirt. I was a bit unnerved. And nothing to do with the sweat stains or anything. I realize that eventually he'll wash it and they'll come out.
Right.
But just those three bands are not really my cup of tea. So he's got a set of brass balls on him to wear that. And it scared me a little bit, but he's not being aggressive about it. So I'm good with it.
I'm far away from him, too.
There you go. How about you, Chris? What t-shirt are you wearing?
Well, mine is a very, very old one, and that's probably why it looks like it's a little snug on me now, because I have matured. But I was a big fan of Willie DeVille. So it's a Mink DeVille t-shirt from probably the early periods, back around 77, around 76, 77. He had the house band, or one of the house bands, at CBGB's. And I'm a New York City kid.
All right. Well, I'm wearing my Prince Purple Rain t-shirt that I've worn multiple times on this podcast, one of my favorite albums of all time. So, Chris, why don't we just start with going way back to the New York days? So, how long were you there in New York? You grew up there, correct?
Yeah, I'm a New York City, a Bronx Yonkers kid, and I lived there until my senior year of high school. We came out to California to San Diego, so I grew up in that area. Basically, if you've seen A Bronx Tale, that movie, that's my neighborhood.
Yeah.
And it was, best I can put it, attitude meant a lot there. So I grew up listening to black music filtered through an Italian neighborhood. So talk about attitude. So it taught me how to groom my hair and what clothes to wear and how to carry yourself. And I actually loved it.
Well, and people are not able to see the video of this, but Chris's hair. So we watched some videos of you back in the early 80s. Your hair still looks immaculate. Like Wayne and I are extremely jealous. We are follically challenged. So the fact that you have this beautiful, and Phil is too. You have this beautiful hair and you've got the chops to go along with it.
Hey, well, I sure appreciate the slap on the back there. And it's funny, I have two sons and almost daily they come out and they inspect my hair and they smile. They're going, "Oh, it looks good, Dad." Yeah. They're just, you know, looking down the road to hopefully they're going to keep theirs hanging on for a while.
Right, right.
Well, thanks. I appreciate it.
Yeah. So I'm assuming in New York is where you got your musical chops. You started there.
It definitely. And what happened was I was lucky enough to be the baby in my family. My parents had two gals and a son, and they thought they were done. But lo and behold, 13 years later, they must have had a fight and made up. And I was the byproduct of that. So I'm 13 years younger than it was okay. My closest sister. And I grew up with all of their records around. So if you look at pictures at Christmas, I'm in front of the Christmas tree as a little guy sitting there. And it's pictures of records that are Duane Eddy and Elvis and Johnny Cash and things like that. So that's what was always on in my house. And then I have pictures. I have one on the wall here. I'm about four, and I'm playing a cowboy plastic acoustic guitar, probably around 1959, in front of the Christmas tree. So I started noodling on guitar at about, I'd say, maybe 3 or 4 years old. And then naturally, the Beatles changed things for so many of us. When I saw that, I invited some of the kids from the neighborhood over and said, "Hey, we're going to put a band together." And I was very lucky. Playing seemed to come just so naturally to me. It was second nature. And I didn't understand that it wasn't so easy for other people to learn to play. I just thought you knew how to play. You just kind of picked it up and went by it. So that kind of put the brakes on forming a band for a while. And then when I was 13, I went to Bronin's Music Store. It was on Webster Avenue in the Bronx, and went with my dad, 13 years old. I had $25 and I wanted an electric guitar. So I found one in there. It was $40. My dad came up with the extra 15, and I was the owner of a metallic blue Ford pickup Norma electric guitar made in Japan. And from then on out, I walked everywhere with my guitar on, playing it, just walking around the streets, going places. And it was just an attraction there. So I started playing a lot at about 13 on, and that's when I was playing electric guitar. My dad had a stereo system, and he put an input into it where I could plug my guitar directly into the input. So I would put it on auxiliary. I could play my guitar through the home speakers there in our apartment. And the poor neighbors probably heard many versions of, my God, everything from California Sun to Dion was a neighborhood hero. He knew my brother. She asked me which one I love the best. I tear open my shirt and I show a rosy on my chest, cause I'm a wanderer. And the neighbors, nobody really minded. It was a very musical neighborhood. It was a lot of Italian, but a lot of Puerto Rican, a lot of Cuban, a lot of black music. So I grew up listening to not only the Dion-type groups, but stuff like the Drifters and the Coasters and the Sam Cooks and the interesting different Latin rhythms. So I mean, I just had so much to feed off of. And everywhere you went, it was coming out of somebody's car radio. It was coming out of a house. A ton of music in New York City. And that then led me to buying records, finding records, which then I had to read the writer's credits and the liner notes. There was nothing like an internet that you could look it up and get your information. So then I'd go to the local library, and we had a bookmobile that would come through the neighborhood that you could check out records in the bookmobile. So it was around us all the time. So that then led me to find out about places, say the Brill Building, which were so many of the Tin Pan Alley New York songwriters would get a room there. Or if you guys are familiar with the Brill Building, yep. So many of the early, you know, just the Barry Mann, Cynthia Wells, Carole King, Neil Diamond, all of them.
Neil Diamond, yeah.
So I learned a lot of it from that. And I really kind of had a bit of an ear for, melody and rhythms. And it was just around all the time. So it was easy to pick up. Like they say, if you go to a foreign country and you want to learn the language, you turn on the local TV and you turn on the radio, and it's easy to pick up. So having all these different styles of music on the radio everywhere you turned, it was easy to assimilate them. I was lucky.
Yeah. So moving to San Diego, did you find the same landscape where it was, you know, a lot of eclectic sounds?
No. And in fact, at first, where we lived, we were out in a corner of San Diego called Spring Valley. And it was a very quiet area. It was very dull as far as music. I wasn't into the FM specialties that were all over the radio. And my taste, they were always out of phase. I'm listening to early Ventures records and listening to the guitar licks. And I was not finding that on the radio. So eventually I fell in with, you know, some of these knuckleheads we'll probably talk about soon, all the Country Dicks and the Jerry Rainies and the Joel Kamaks and all of these guys. And then Buddy, too. Buddy's another ex-New Yorker. He was an upstate guy, but a Syracuse guy who came out here at to wrap up high school also. So we all kind of fell in by having unique tastes in music, and we enjoyed hanging out and going through each other's record collections and just jamming together, picking up our instruments because we all played. So we all had a different feel for, you know, this was pre-corporate rock, but just what we were hearing at the time was not blowing up our skirt.
So this was mid-70s?
Yeah, I came out right at the end there. I came out 72, 73, and Buddy shortly after that. So I fell in with not so much the guys in high school, but my first year of junior college out here. I went to a junior college called Grossmont, and I fell in with a bunch of different guys in that area, and then they were friends. So we were all in El Cajon, Spring Valley, La Mesa, and it seemed like everybody knew somebody that knew somebody else, that we had this interesting taste in music. Then it would go to, say, British Invasion. You know, Dan would show up with, you know, Kinks records, and, you know, we were listening to unique blues records. Not so much, I don't want to say the pop blues, but blues was just coming back in. Again, it was being filtered through England and back to us. So we are, as American, you know, Americans were rediscovering some of these blues things we should have known about. But instead of just going for the pop blues guys, we were digging a little bit deeper. So I remember going to see Sonny Terry and Brownie McGee when I was 17. And I went to also see Clarence Carter. He was playing in a black club. I think it was called the Dolphin, but it was a 21 and older club. And it was in a bad part of town, but I showed up. I'm 17. I'm talking to the doorman, and he's looking at me and just smiling and laughing. And he's asking, "What brings you out here?" And I said, "Well, Clarence Carter is playing." He said, "What do you know about Clarence Carter?" So I said, "Oh, my dad's favorite song was Patches, and, you know, and I love this, and, you know, and I listen to stuff like James Carr, Dark End of the Street." And he's laughing. He's saying, "Man, if there's one kid that needs to come in here, it's you. But you're 17, and this is a 21 and older club." And as I'm looking past them, there are guys in there. They got their pistols on the table and stuff. It was like something out of a Scorsese movie. I didn't realize it at 17.
I was born and raised down in Alabama on a farm way back up in the woods. I was so ragged that folks used to call me Patches. Papa used to tease me about it, 'cause deep down inside he was hurt, 'cause he'd done all he could. My papa was a great old man. I can see him with a shovel in his hand. See, education he never had. He did wonders when the times got bad. The little money from the crops he raised barely paid the bills we made. Oh, life had kicked him down to the ground. When he tried to get up, life would kick him back down. One day, Papa called me to his dying bed, put his hands on my shoulder, then in tears he said, Patches, I'm depending on you, son.
But I just had a little different tastes on it. But I probably grew up around that kind of environment. So it was just natural for me. And then these other knuckleheads that we'll talk about in a little bit, I fell in with them. And we all had that same love of, rock and roll and a little bit of the greasier side of town.
Yeah.
So anyway, that was a long answer, but no, I found a barren wasteland to some degree when I first came out here.
You guys get together. Do you all decide to form a band, or are there multiple bands that are getting formed from this little
at the time
that you guys have established?
Well, I was the newest guy to town, and then eventually Buddy was. But before I really knew Buddy, I answered an ad, and at that point, I think it was in a local newspaper. That's where you would find them in jobs for hire. And it was Joel Kamak, who's known as Bongo. He's the drummer in the Farmers. He and another fellow, Scott Harrington, who was playing guitar, placed an ad, something about looking for a roots-oriented bass player, English invasion. I don't think they used the term oldies, but they might have said influenced by Gene Vincent, a plus, Dave Clark Five, a plus, that kind of thing. So I came out.
So they're looking for a bass player, though.
A bass player, yeah. That's what they're looking for.
And up to that point, had you played bass, or were you more of the lead guitar?
Well, actually, no. When I was right about 13, when I bought the electric guitar, I didn't realize, but the things I really heard and was drawing close to was probably a baritone guitar and eventually the bass. So I started as a regular guitar player. And then I learned pretty quickly that I have to get a bass. So I picked up my very first bass guitar. I remember what it was. It was a Fender Telecaster bass, 1968. I bought it from Danny Como, that I remember that, for $125. And I started playing bass right at about 13, too. So I was playing guitar and bass, but I became pretty much a bass player. So I was ready to go when I auditioned with these guys. And I didn't know at the time, but I guess when I left, they're each nudging each other going, well, I think we found our guy. What do you think? Yeah, we found our guy. So we decided to put a band together. And about 3 weeks into putting that band together, Joel, the drummer, he had a great job offer from a band called the Hitmakers. And it was one of these job offers that, hey, if you'll join our band, one of the guys in the band is married to the Irving family, and she just wrote with her dad the Book of Lists, and there's some money behind it. So we're going to move to London for 6 months. So if you join the band, would you mind moving to London and having everything paid for the next 6 months? So it was either move to London with the Hitmakers or start a brand new band after 3 weeks and stick with that band. So I think Joel made a wise decision. Yeah. He chose to go to London. So when he did that, now I was left with Scott, he and I, and we needed a singer and we needed a drummer. So we started putting ads up around town. I came up with a flyer, and I took it to my favorite record stores, and I would drop this flyer in the bins of my favorite bands. So I would drop a flyer in the bin of maybe the Dave Clark Five or somewhere in the bin of, like Suzy Q 45 or things that I liked. And I wound up, we got a couple of interests from people, and we got an interest from a fellow named Gary Heffern. He was a singer. So Scott and I went to hear him sing. And at the time, he wasn't much of a singer, but he was a great showman. He was like Daffy Duck flopping around a room and working the audience and stuff. So Scott and I looked at each other and go, this guy we can work with him. Hopefully we can teach him to sing here. He was a great showman. So at this point, we had Scott, myself, and Gary Heffern, and we were looking for drummers. So the same thing, guys were answering our ads, and they would show up at Scott's house for an audition, and it was like a scene in The Commitments where guys would show up with these giant drum kits, 6-7 drums and racks of cymbals. And we're going, didn't know how to play them. Or yeah, since they didn't know how to play them, they hit everything as much as they could. And there was no groove, no rhythm. So sometimes we would just open the door and we'd look at each other and just shut the door again. Thanks for coming. So we were struggling. But then we found Dan McLean, who became later known as Country Dick. Yeah. And Country Dick was actually a piano player to start. He used to go to Joel's house. Joel's dad kind of ran the household. Joel had two brothers, and he always opened up his household. This is talking about Joel's dad, to musicians and us kids that needed a place to go. You know, if you were hungry, there was going to be something to eat in the refrigerator. If you need to sleep on a couch, he had it. And he taught me a lot. And that's kind of how my sons grew up in our household with their friends. If somebody needed a place to spend the night or something to eat in the refrigerator, we had our household open. And I learned a lot of that from Mr. K, Mr. Kamak. So, thanks. Hey, I'm taking a minute off here. We've got Phil just brought me a beverage. So Dan came and said, you know, I play piano, but I got a feel for the drums. And we worked him out, and lo and behold, he had that rhythm, and he knew where to play. He knew how to be in a band. So then that band became the Penetrators. It was Country Dick on drums, Scott Harrington on guitar. I was playing bass, and Gary Heffern on vocals. So we were plodding along, writing some music, and we were starting to get kind of full of ourselves, going, you know, we think we're pretty good. So some of the local promoters were coming around and saying, hey, would you be interested in doing this show or that show? So one of the shows we got offered was the very first Western tour for the Ramones. And we got offered to do the show over at San Diego State. And at the time, Scott, and he still chooses to say he just thought we weren't ready. I think he had a little bit of stage fright. He was saying, no, we're not ready. We can't do it. We're not ready. So finally, the three of us put our foot down, or feet down, I guess it would be plural, and said, look, we're going to do the show with you or not. What do you want to do? So he said, well, if you're going to do it, you're going to have to do it without me. So we started asking around, and we found a terrific guitar player named Chris Davies. So Chris said, sure, I'll be in the band. I'll join the band. And I was apprehensive for our first practice, thinking, I have to teach this guy a whole bunch of songs here. And we only have, I think it was like 2 weeks or 10 days until the Ramones show. Well, we got together at practice, and I didn't realize it, but Chris Davies was showing up at all our shows with a cassette player recording all our shows. So he then would go home at night and learn all the songs. So as soon as we got together to practice, Chris knew the songs.
He knew them.
Yeah. He knew them. So that was at that point when the Penetrators were a four-piece. We had our band, and we went on a few other tours eventually with the Ramones. They would pick us up. We do West Coast shows with them, which led to other tours with the Robert Gordons. And we got to play with Robert Gordon when he had Chris Spedding and when he had Danny Gatton and when he had Link Wray and all these guys. So we would pick up a lot of the New York bands coming out west. So we became, you know, technically, I guess we were considered a new wave band. And what was new wave? It was a rock and roll band. And that's what they called rock and roll in those days. So that was the band. And then about a year into it, we picked up Jim Call. Now, Jim played keyboards more for Fisa Oregon, some interesting sounds on the synthesizer, and he played saxophone. So that gave us a little bit of a slant towards maybe the Dave Clark Five. So we had that run from 77 till 84, and around the end of 83, Country Dick, Dan McLean, had the Beat Farmers he was starting up. So he eventually left in 83 to do the Beat Farmers full time, and then, lo and behold, we got Joel Kamak back again to be the drummer in the Penetrators. So Joel started out for 3 weeks with us, and he wrapped up the last year with us. And now to this day, well, I'm in the Farmers with Joel. Jerry Rainey and Corbin Turner. And actually, Jerry's son plays with us quite a bit too, Nathan Rainey.
So I got to tell on myself. So when I'm trying to do research, I was listening to The Penetrators that's on Spotify. And lo and behold, that is not the San Diego Penetrators, I come to find out. You posted, yeah, that's, I think that's the New York band, which it was good. I enjoyed it. I kind of made mention that it reminded me a lot of the Sonics. Wayne and I grew up in Tacoma, Washington. So Sonics are, I mean, Wayne, they're kind of royalty in Tacoma, sure. I would say.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And there's your Adventures tie-in also.
And absolutely, absolutely. So you mentioned that, yeah, that's not us. So I did go out to YouTube and check some stuff out. So first question on that is, did you know that this other Penetrators band existed?
We didn't at the time, no. And there's been a few. There's also a surf band out of, I believe it's Tuscaloosa, Alabama. And they've been going at it for quite a while.
I saw them too.
They're on there. And there was another Penetrators somewhere in the West. But when we got our start, I always tried to be a step ahead. So we had I copyrighted the name. And then our music publishing was called Heaven 17. And I got that signed off. So if anything big was to ever happen, luckily I've got the legalities in place for our music publishing and for the band name. But no, I didn't know of them at the time, or I would have picked a different name.
Were there formal albums that you all put out? Because again, I didn't see anything out there on Spotify. It's on YouTube.
Yeah, we had two albums. One was probably considered a little more of an EP. That was called Walk the Beat.
Okay.
And on that, we had some pretty well-selling singles, a lot of airplay off of that. We had Walk the Beat itself. With the guys, I get them mixed up here.
I like
Nervous Fingers.
I like
I Five. So
I like that one.
We
too.
Did pretty well with them. Where we were KROQ up in Los Angeles, we were in their top 10. I think we were the number 9 song of the year for 1980 or 81. Where we were up there with other new wave bands, but we were beating out. Well, bands like the Stones and stuff like that. So we became kind of the darlings, and that was with the Walk the Beat. And then we put out an album called A Sweet Kiss for Mommy. And I don't know if you've seen the cover of that, but Jim Call, who's in the Penetrators, had a hobby of taking naked butt pictures of all his friends. And he had them all over his wall in his living room. And they were on Polaroids. So one day we're at Jim's house, I think we're rehearsing, and we're trying to come up with an album concept. And I looked over his fireplace, and he had all these Polaroids of people's butts. But they weren't like pornographic or anything. They were like little, pictures of maybe a father and his 3-month-old son. And then at the time, we knew a couple of the gals were the Playboy bunnies. So it was a couple of them with their bunny tails on. And we thought this could maybe be fun. So the album cover probably has 40, 50 pictures of Polaroids of people's butts, but nothing, especially by today's terms, you would think is any sort of suggest. We just thought it was funny. So after a while, a few of the major record stores, though, would say, well, we can't display the record in our end caps. We can't put this out. So that started a bit of a battle. And then I remember it was Larry Flint with What was his magazine there?
Penthouse or Playboy?
Hustler. He did a big write up on the band, going, at least these guys, they have the balls to put out an album cover like this, and more power to them, and rights and this and that. So he gave us a big write up, and he was kept banging the drum, the power of the Penetrators, just that let these guys, they should be able to do what they want. So we were getting some write-ups, and we didn't do it to get the write-ups, but we got both positive and negative on the album cover. So that one, anyway, A Sweet Kiss from Mommy, that had some songs on it, like Nothing Town, a little more sax oriented. That one did very well, as well as Walk the Beat in Europe, too. So when I would get some of my residual checks, I seemed to make more in Japan and in Europe than we did in the States. But for a while, for an independent record company, which we started, we called it Eggs and Mice, we did pretty well. And in those days, I probably knew a little bit too much about the business than I should have. So I found out about, no, I'm not going to sign away our publishing. And, they wanted us to maybe sign off some writer's credits. So I did my homework, but we had the meetings with, my God, with David Geffen, and we were sitting down with Atlantic and Elektra, and I can picture them all, CBS. And we were there with some of the big shot, the Irving Azoffs and stuff, kind of negotiating. And I remember one of the times we were negotiating over at the A&M Sound Studios, because IRS was interested. And at the time, it was one of the guys in The Police. His brother was a big shot.
You guys would have fit well on IRS.
Yeah. So I remember him coming down, and he wanted us to change a couple of the guys in the band, which I wouldn't do. And he said, oh, well, we can get a session guy for this, and we can do that. And I'm saying, you're interested in signing the band. And they didn't see us live enough to see the live show, because our live shows won a lot of people over. And yet I thought our stuff was kind of hooky. I would write the music with a lot of hooks and melodies. You could walk away humming or whistling. So we ultimately, well, the last big one, we thought we were going to get a deal with IRS, but the band they signed instead of us were The Police.
They did okay.
Yeah, The Police did okay.
I remember we were doing a video shoot at the IRS A&M soundstage it was Romeo Void, us and a band called U2. And U2 hung out. And I remember Bono at the time, I just didn't care for him. He just seemed so smug. And he kept looking at us with his nose up and would ask me just interesting questions about what we were doing. So we had to go do a couple of TV shows and things with them at the time. But anyway, we didn't get the gig. So we just would not sign our royalties away. We were not giving up publishing and certain writers' credits. So I might have known too much.
Yeah, I was going to say, based off of what I heard, I mean, they probably turned around and signed Wall of Voodoo instead, right? Probably pretty comparable.
They may have. And
yeah.
Yeah, and we remained friends with a lot of the Wall of Voodoo guys. A couple of them live down here in San Diego. Yeah. And over the years, whether it's, say, Josie Cotton or Peter Case or Dave Alvin, so many of us have remained very close friends. And we grew up in that scene playing the mask and playing just interesting places all around the Hollywood spots, all the Wong Wars, Madame Wong's, and Hong Kong Gardens and Club 88. I mean, you go on and on. The Whiskey. Yeah. I have some great stories of the Whiskey and the Roxy. We had a funny one. I'm going way off tangent, but like I say, I have a lot of stories. and they're true.
It's all good. I want to hear about the whiskey. Yeah, give me a story from the whiskey.
Well, the whiskey, I have a couple of pictures of the different marquees where we're the headliner, but there were bands like Berlin or Missing Persons opening up. And we'd be out on tour with LA them at band. Times. And they were all kind of new rock stars, and they were trying to go through their rock star pomp and circumstances on the road and, you know, interesting things. Well, we're not moving our drums or we're not doing this. And we kind of laughed at them. But the guys up at the Roxy and the Whiskey were very nice. It was Elmer Valentine owned the Whiskey, but Mario was the manager for the Whiskey and the Roxy. And Elmer was an ex-Chicago cop, and he went to Paris, saw some discotheques starting, and he brought that back to L.A. and started the Whiskey. Now, he hired Mario, and I think Mario maybe had some connections, shall we just say, in and out of the business. And Mario cared about the musicians. Mario always took a liking to me. We'd be playing in there, and he'd come up, and in those days, he'd like stick a 20 in my pocket, and he'd say, "I got something to eat there, Sully, you're getting skinny." These kind of things. You know, they were tough guys, but they looked out for us kids and us musicians. So I just have nothing but fond memories of the Whiskey and the Roxy, where they always fed us. They gave us some beers. They gave us some couple extra bucks on the side. They took care of us. Later on, those places became the pay-to-play kind of places. Yeah. But here in the late 70s, early 80s, they took great care of us. My hat's off, or I'll nod my pompadour here to both Mario. And I knew Mario the best, and Elmer. But some of the funny things, one of them, when we were playing at the Roxy, we were playing with Robert Gordon when Danny Gatton was in the band. I'm sure you guys are familiar with Danny Gatton.
Yeah.
And Danny's family has a movie out about him right now called The Humbler, because his sound checks were incredible. He could do things in the sound checks nobody else could do. And when he was playing with Robert Gordon, who, and I can speak some of these stories too, and unfortunately Robert just passed away, he would tell Danny to play like you're 13 years old. He didn't want him to steal the show from Robert.
There's one tune left. My gal is red hot, your gal ain't toodle is my gal. My gal is red hot, your gal ain't toodle is my gal. She ain't got one, she's really got a dog. Man, I got a gal, 64, really feeling, could you really be that dog, man? My gal is red hot, your gal ain't toodle is my gal. My gal is red hot, your gal ain't toodle is my gal. She ain't got one, she's really got a dog.
So we're doing, we're playing, I think we had two or three days up at the Roxy, and we're opening the show, we're on stage, and all of a sudden the crowd stands up in the Roxy, because I think it was a lot of people seated at tables, and they stood up and they started looking towards the back of the room, and we're all looking around while we're playing going, is there a fight going on or what's happening here? And it stuck with us for about the length of a song. So after we finish our set and we come off stage, we're asking Mario and saying, what was the commotion there in the crowd? What's going on? And he said, oh, that was probably when the Stones came in. And I said, really? The Stones were here? And he goes, yeah, but they're not here anymore. Oh, where are they? In your dressing room. Oh, so we go back and here we've got, we have like Keith and Ronnie Wood and Marissa Berenson, who was hanging out with them, an actress, and they're hanging out in our dressing room. They came to see Danny Gatton, but they just took a fondness to us. So now here we are, the Penetrators, hanging out with the Stones in our dressing room. So things like that would happen at the Roxy or the Whiskey. And we were just lucky enough to be, somewhat charming to kind of blend in with them.
Yeah.
That was anyway, a story of those days. And I don't remember where we were going with them, but we did play a lot of the LA shows. And you know, we did a lot of San Francisco shows. We'd be up there at the Mabuhay with like the Dead Kennedys and God, what were the bands up there? The Avengers and different things. And we played up there quite a bit. And we did very well on the West Coast. We did our Western tours where we'd go up through Denver and Fort Collins, and Boulder was a fun town, and your typical Salt Lake cities and Phoenix, Tucson's, you know, the Western U.S. And we had a very good time. We did well. We sold a lot of records, sold a lot of T-shirts. We did well.
But never got to New York to contend with the other penetrators?
Face off.
We didn't. No, we seemed to stop right there at the Mississippi. The old Miss. Okay. There you go. We stopped there.
Do you still have any of the records of the Penetrators, those albums that you guys put out?
You know, I do. I only have a couple of Walk the Beat. They sell very well in Japan, where they're going up there $100 to $300 from what I gather. So I saved one for each of my kids, and I probably have a couple. I do have a full box of Sweet Kiss from Mommy, so I should get you guys a couple of those. I have those on vinyl. Yeah. And they do well overseas also. And I keep that box here for older fans I run into. And if I know they're going to be around, I like to surprise them and just drop them a record and say, hey, here's a gift and thanks for being there. How many years ago in 77, 78? So I have those. And then we put out a couple of singles also. Our very first single was cut in Pasadena on Hound Dog Records. And that was a three-song, well, I guess it was a three-song EP. And that was, at the time, the original Penetrators before Jim Caw was in the band. We had that. And then we were on a label called World Records. And we had a single, Sensitive Boy, backed with Stimulation. And that did pretty well also. So we had two albums and two single EPs.
On
and we have another unique story too. Oh, go ahead.
I was going to say that a Sweet Kiss from Mommy. I'm looking at Discogs, and it does have the original Butts cover. So there's median price is about $20. So not bad for an older record. Yeah.
I'll get you guys a couple of copies here. I'll give them to Phil and have them. Get them to you guys.
That'd be great. That'd be great.
That'd be awesome.
Yeah. So at what point do the Penetrators go their separate ways? Is it you do all these showcases for all the labels and have this realization that maybe it's just not going to be major label stuff?
Yep. That came in 84. And I think we all felt that it was a mutual decision that, you know, we've had the sit downs with all the big shots at the labels at the time. And we were like maybe a Springsteen type of group before, like a voice like he had before that was really selling records or they thought wasn't going to sell records. So we decided, hey, it's not going to happen for us. Gary moved to Seattle. I stayed here in town. And then I was fairly lucky from doing a lot of shows in L.A. and a few other places. I was always involved in music. I fell in with the music circles both in Los Angeles and in Nashville. So I was able to go back and forth and do a few recording stints in L.A. and then some in Nashville. And I fell in with both those scenes. I was lucky enough, being a New York guy, that I had a pretty broad width of music and my knowledge of it. So when I fell in with the guys from Nashville, Here I'm a rock and roll guy in my 20s, but I knew the old country records from my brother and my sisters.
Yeah.
So I knew the country licks. And at that point, the country guys in Nashville, they were trying to get them to become more rock and roll. So luckily enough, I fell in with a guy I knew, eventually became very good friends with a guy named Joe Galante. Now, at the time, I knew Joe's wife, George Ann. They were both Brooklyn, New York City kids. And Joe was kind of a bean counter for RCA Records. And they sent him to Nashville to kind of organize the label down there and to perhaps cut the dead wood they thought they had on the label in Nashville. So when Joe moved to town, they hated him because he'd have to go in and tell some of the established artists, you don't have a contract with RCA any longer. We have to, you know, he wouldn't say cut the dead wood, but he had to let people go. So eventually he learned country music. And again, he was just more of a treasurer. He was a bean counter, but he learned how to fit in Nashville. So I remember I would go to secondhand stores with his wife, George Ann, and she'd say, oh, you know, we're having the most fun. Come join us, Joe. So instead of him just picking up the Country Squire station wagon and joining us, he'd show up in like a limousine at these, you know, secondhand stores. And we'd kind of cringe our face a little bit, go, no, Joe, that's not really it, Joe. You know, you got to leave that behind and try to find a 64 Valiant and join us.
Right.
So he eventually got in the swing of things. And then I remember him telling me at the time, too, that Nashville, well, the record companies run Nashville and try not to get in trouble here. If you get in trouble, we can kind of get you off. Please don't kill anybody. That's harder. And he would have these discussions with me. So I wound up going to different recording sessions with these kids from RCA, and that opened up the doors through like CBS. I became good friends with the Rowland family. It was a very good friend of mine. She was a promotions person on CBS, and at the time she was married to Dave Rowlands. Dave was in the it was Elvis's vocal background group, not the Jordanaires. It was in J.D. Sumner and the Stamps Quartet. So Dave Rowland had a band called Dave and Sugar, which was kind of really cheesy. It was like the country version of Tony Orlando and Dawn. So Vicki Rowland was married to him. So now I started going to the CBS showcases, and then I fell in with Debbie Gibson, not the star Debbie Gibson, another gal who worked at MCA, who was a promo gal. So now I started going to the RCA set and MCA sessions, and then eventually Mary Tyler Moore had MTM Records right down there on Music Row. They were being distributed by Capitol. So I fell in with the young new songwriters down there. The songwriters at the time, a few of them made it, a few didn't. So I fell in with them. So all of a sudden now here I am in my 20s. I'm a rock and roll guy, but I knew country, and I'm falling in with the newer rock and roll country people. Okay. But I'm becoming friends with these like old 45-year-old guys from the country circuit.
Yeah.
But they're thinking, he's a good kid. He's got chops and he knows his stuff. So then I started getting invited to play on certain records and things. And since I wasn't starstruck, I said, no, he's all right. Invite him out. Have him over to the barbecue. And I just worked my way in. And that was the Nashville. But then going up to L.A., different producers I fell in with. We were very lucky. One of the guys who was our manager at the time, Denny Bruce. I don't know if you know the name Denny. Now, Denny handled the Fabulous Thunderbirds.
Yeah, yeah.
A bunch of us were with Denny. So he had the ins. He was the first guy to get the ins with Miller Beer and stuff. So Denny hooked me up with a producer, Ron Capone. Now, Ron was out of Memphis, and Ron worked a lot for Stax Records. He won a Grammy for Shaft, and he came to L.A., and he worked at a lot of the studios in L.A. We did some work up at, I think it was called Castle Oaks, which was on the way, Thousand Oaks, out there. I don't know the area very well as you started to head towards Ventura.
Okay.
And I remember he got me involved with Buddy Miles, and Buddy Miles was doing the California Raisin Records. So I fell in doing some of that work. And Ron was a very good guy, very nice guy. So Ron actually helped us out with the Jacks, who I'm probably eventually aiming this towards. And the Jacks became the band that Buddy and I put together. Buddy left, had a pulling out with the Beat Farmers. So Buddy and I put that together with Joe Longa, who had played with Doug Kershaw, the Raging Cajun, and with Jack Penny. Now, Jack was in the original Iron Butterfly, and he played with Jerry Rainey in Glory and Jerry Rainey in The Shame. So we put together a band called The Jacks. And we got a deal through Ron Capone. He recorded us, and we signed what we thought was a good deal with Rounder Records. I remember Clarence Gatemouth Brown and George Thorogood telling us don't sign with Rounder because they had just left Rounder. But Rounder said, hey, you guys will be the first record that we're putting out, not only on cassette and record, you'll be our first CD. And eventually, instead of being their first CD, we were the last only cassette player and or cassette and record. And they talked us into signing by saying things like, well, we do math the old-fashioned way. And they did. That's because they used pencils and they had erasers on the end. But anyway, that kind of happened with Rounder.
They had an abacus.
Yes. So that opened up doors for me with other producers in L.A., to where all of a sudden I'd be at a session, we'd record in maybe the control room, and they'd say, well, this guy's a good bass player. Have him play on this session. So, you know, you play on hundreds of records, thousands of records. You don't know what might click, what might stick. So I played on some real dogs, but I've always played my hardest. And I played on a few million sellers. So, you know, it opened up doors. And if you knew the producers in those days, that's how you got your work. So I was on many records. And one of the things I think that Phil asked me to bring up that he was kind of a little surprised by, the average person that doesn't really dig into the metrics of the way the record industry works, especially back 30 years ago, it might say the such and such band has such and such on guitar, such and such on bass, such and such on drums, and such on keyboard. And that is the band. Well, that is the band, but that's not necessarily the band that's playing on the records. That's who's in right. the band. So in those days, we wound up playing, which I'm not able to speak about, on many people's records. That, yes, the band was these guys listed on the record, but the record doesn't say that's who's playing on the record. It says that's who's in the band. So a lot of guys would get what they call red light fever. When that red recording light comes on, they freeze up and they're thinking, I can't make a mistake. So the first thing you do is make a mistake.
Yeah.
So they would use a lot of us that didn't have the stage fright of the studio to come in, record records, and then maybe they would have a favorite person. Like I had certain producers that liked the way I played bass because I would come up with kind of melodic hooks, a little turns and stuff, and play like counterpoint melodies. So I fell in with some of these people and got a lot of work. And it worked out for me at the time because then I started having a few kids. So I didn't have to go on the road and play in touring bands. I was able to do some studio work. So I had a good time for a while there doing studio work.
So what is the pay in the residuals? If you're not being listed on the credits, So are you only getting paid for the day of,
yep,
of you being in the studio?
That's it. You're being paid in the studio the day up. Okay. There's no residuals. Nowadays, well, they don't need as many session players now as they used to. They will work different contracts, and depending on how big you are and who you're playing with, there are residuals being paid, or there were residuals being paid. When I was doing it, it was a great day's pay. Now, depending where you were, if you had to go through the union, depending, like, say, if you're in the Nashville scene, you would go through the union, and the standard session, they would ask you to try to cut 4 songs in a 3-hour period. That was kind of a Nashville staple.
Okay.
But it wasn't always held that way. LA was a little different. There was some union work, and you had to join Local 47 up there, or you would record on the side, just with a producer. And in those days, and I'll say here in the 80s, let me just say mainly in the 80s, there were all different types of deals being worked. They would just pay you on the side. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of money being made and being thrown around in the studios of those days. Some of these studios would charge incredible amounts per hour to the bands or to the labels. And a lot of these new and young bands would think, this is great. I've got a $1 million recording contract with MCA. But no, MCA is not handing you $1 million. They are keeping track of everything, the water you drink in the studio, to the hired session guys that come in, to this or that. And certain bands think, oh, this is great. We'll record it, 24 track. And hey, can you hook up 2 boards? Can we do 48 track? The money, all of a sudden they'd be hit with a bill going, I'll never be able to pay this in my life. And that happened to so many new young bands. The pay what the studios were making was incredulous.
Yeah.
But we would all kind of work a separate deal. And luckily enough, I was able to sit in on certain sessions that I didn't get credit for, but I hear myself, I go, well, I know that's me playing on that. Some of the bands that were around that had giant implosions at the time were, say, like Lone Justice, and I'm sure you guys are familiar with them. They Love came that. Out of Hollywood High, and they basically imploded due to money, cocaine, big shots. So, Iovine would fire the band and hire new people, and then there'd be singles and different things being cut. And I mean, just, I could go on and on. It was just a time. There was so much going on. You had to be involved at it or in it at the time. I'm sure a lot of the folks listening to this that were musicians at the time know exactly what I'm talking about. You might just show up and all of a sudden you're cutting with Josie Cotton, and then it could be whoever at the time.
Yeah. So you mentioned the Nashville stuff during the 80s. So if I pull out one of my Kenny Rogers albums, are you on any of those?
No. A lot of the real big names, like the Kenny Rogers, I wasn't on those.
Okay.
Now, there's something Eddie that Rabbit? Still goes on to this. I was very good friends with Eddie Rabbit. I didn't play on him, but we became very good friends. He was a truck driver from New Jersey, and we had a common link. I remember telling him, I was at a party actually for Frank Yankovic, not Weird Al, in Nashville, when Frank Yankovic was putting out a polka record in the 80s, and we ran into each other, and Eddie was a chain smoker too, and he was just hard to hang around with because he smoked so much. But we were talking about, his songs, Love a Rainy Night, and I was talking about Kentucky Rain when Elvis cut that for him, and he was so surprised here again that, I'm a kid in my 20s, that knew all these things about these songs. Yeah. So I fell in with the guys. So I didn't record with Eddie, but we hung out a lot together. He's a very good guy. So the guys that I kind of fell in with more would be the like the John Schneiders and stuff. And he was from Dobbs Ferry, New York, of all things. Ed Bruce. Became very good friends with Mel Tillis. And Mel in public had a bit of a stuttering and stammering problem. So if we were at just a record company get together, he'd put his arm around my shoulder and he would just go, you tell him. But if he was acting or singing, he was great. It was no flaws, but he couldn't speak in public. So I fell in with a lot of the guys of that kind of ilk. Earl Thomas Conley, I'm trying to think of all them that were around.
Yeah.
Anyway, very good guys. And it was just a fun time for me. And I got to see a lot of Nashville. I wouldn't know it today. I haven't been there in a long time, but I hear it's so different nowadays.
People can't see the video, but you have a number of, are those gold records, platinum records on your wall?
Yeah, what lucky are, enough I got a few. I don't know. They're all, some of them were like, MCA were the cheapest guys as you look around here. I didn't necessarily get a gold record for just one specific album, but on some of these, I don't know, maybe over here. See, like there's one there where it looks like it's got 30 records on it. If I played on one of those records that was gold, they would make, instead of making like 10 gold records or 20 gold records for that one album, they'd produce like 500 of these and give them to everybody. They didn't have to take the records, because what they actually did, real gold records were vinyl records. They would take in and they would spray paint them gold. A friend of mine, Dan Chusett, shout out to Dan Chusett, worked for his uncle's company back in New Jersey, and they made the gold records. So it was funny. They would just take them from cutout bins, take the records, spray paint them gold, and they'd make the gold records.
Slap the label on it.
And that's what it was. And the only guy early on that wanted to hold true was Springsteen. If he was getting a gold record for one of his records that had six cuts on one side, he wanted to make sure it had six cuts where you could see it. Nobody else cared. So a few of these, a few were gold. There's some platinum and 500s and stuff. So I got lucky on a few of these. And then the singles were a lot of fun too, though.
Yeah, which one is your favorite of those?
You know, one of them, just because we didn't know and didn't make any sense, there was Tracy Ullman. Do you remember the early Tracy Ullman shows?
I do.
Well, when she first got started, a bunch of us played on that. The one where Paul McCartney's in the video. What's the name of that song? I feel stupid now.
They Don't Know About Us.
They Don't Know. Yeah, that one.
They Don't Know About Us.
One of them. And I think on there, too, it's kind of funny. One of my sons came up with one of my 45s. And on one of the 45s, it said this was recorded in England, which it wasn't. But anyway, so that was a fun one because nobody knew Tracy Ullman at the time. She was 17 or something when she was cutting here. So those kind of ones are fun when they just pop up. Other ones, you know, people with big names like your Glenn Fry's or things. And so, but you weren't necessarily there. They weren't in the studio when you're cutting it. They just came in with a bunch of material for you to play on. And then later on, whoever the big shot was would come in and play on the record.
Gotcha.
You know, do the vocal later. So you didn't even necessarily meet those people. One of the things that my kids love, though, at the time, it seems like all the companies like Disney and Hollywood Records, every major company, whether it was Capitol, would have their offshoot of like a kids record or something to do. So they then would get me free passes to places like maybe Universal Studios would be through MCA or the Disney Records, I think. Okay. I think, was that Hollywood Records? Anyway, Disney had their own label. So I could take the kids to Disneyland for free and MCA Universal Studios for free or Knott's Berry Farm. So growing up, the kids thought this was great. You know, once a month we'd go to one of these places because dad knew guys in the record company. And so that was probably things that made my kids super happy in those days, but no residuals.
Yeah. The perks of doing that. Yeah, for sure.
The perks of doing it. And it just you made a lot of friends.
Yeah, so let's fast forward to you getting back with all of your old friends. So when does the Farmers become a thing?
Well, I joined the Farmers in 2008, And okay. What had happened was I went to see them play one night, and they asked me to come up and play a couple of songs. And I did. And at the time, I was thinking maybe the band, both Raleigh and Jerry, were maybe not getting along. Raleigh was the initial bass player. And Raleigh's okay. a great friend of mine. And, you know, I was giving Raleigh lessons early on. I was there when Raleigh joined the Beat Farmers and got all that rolling. But he and Jerry were just not getting along. And for some reason, it was time for a change. So I think after I sat in with them this one night, it kind of set the stage for if we need to make a change, we got it. And then about a month later, I got a call from Jerry, and it was kind of the way Dan Country Dick recruited Jerry. I think Jerry kind of recruited me like that, going, well, we're making a change. It's just not working out. We're not getting along. And I think his line was something like that. What do you think about joining a rock and roll pleasure machine or something like that, that Country Dick used on Jerry? So I went in and sat in with the guys, and we just, it's been an incestuous music scene here in San Diego that we knew each other so well. And yeah. I kind of just knew the songs in the back of my head, and they knew the way I played. And then we all grew up on blues and country. And when people ask me, you know, what are the Farmers like? I said, well, we're a rock and roll band, but we have a foot in country and a foot in blues, and we were a size 12, so we cover a lot of ground. And it was just, we hit the road running, so we were able to start gigging right away. And now, if you think about it, God, that's been 15, 16 years now. So it's worked out very well for us. And yet everybody still gets along. In fact, as I'm doing this right now, the original Beat Farmers, well, Buddy had passed away, but Joey, so we got Joey, Jerry, Raleigh, and Joel Bongo, they're playing in Novato, California tonight, Tuesday, as the Beat okay. Farmers. They've got four shows in the West Coast here in California, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. And then they'll be back to town, then we'll go back doing as the Farmers. Because we're always playing, as I was just telling Phil, too. I also play on the side. I mean, my band is the Farmers, but I play with Sarah Petit. And Sarah and I have been best friends for about 15 years. She's got a new album out. So when I can, I play with Sarah also just to keep my chops up. Because as we're getting older, you got to keep up your calluses and your muscle memory and your, your muscles, your tendons, your ligaments.
And you guys have put out two albums since you've been in the band?
Yeah, right? I guess it's – was it three? Well,
three?
Well, I'm thinking we put out Fulmination and we put out The Farmers, I'm trying to think. I don't know if we have a name for SD. You might be thinking of Loaded, Phil.
No.
No. Oh.
I think there's three because I think I got three.
And what's the third one I'm missing? Because when Buddy was still in the band before Buddy passed, they put out a band called an album called Loaded. And that one comes up from time to time.
And you have a copy of that there.
And right? I do have that one. Yeah.
And I'm trying to think. We had a few other ones. Like we recorded a couple live ones we never put out. And why, I don't really know. We'll have a song here or there that we'll put on a sampler or somewhere. But I'm thinking it's just the two. I'm thinking it's the Fulmination and the other one. We're all standing on the cover. We're on a bar, believe it or not.
And just looking straight ahead?
Looking straight ahead.
So it must be just two.
That's just a Farmer's SD. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. All right, Phil. Did we miss any questions that you wanted to ask Chris?
Baseball.
Ah, baseball. Well, I love baseball. I don't know how you guys feel about it, but
we love it.
Well, that was my first calling as a kid. I always wanted to play baseball, and I think that's what I want to do for a living. I want to play. I played baseball. I played music. I always played. And my other source of other day jobs, I was a disc jockey, so I played disc jockey. I did some voiceovers. Okay. I played with things. But growing up, I wanted to play baseball, and I became pretty darn good at it. So I was very lucky. I got a lot of interest from the Kansas City Royals. And back in the day, they had a Kansas City Royals Baseball Academy. It was a combination minor league system and a college. And the last big name guy to come through that was Willie Wilson. He was kind of in my recruiting group. So they wanted me to come down to Florida and join the Kansas City Royals Baseball Academy, which was minor league and school. But at the time, that was right when my dad was very sick. And that's when we were leaving New York City. He couldn't take the cold any longer. And he had a couple of heart attacks and a stroke, and we had to leave New York. So my sister knew San Diego. Unfortunately, my brother-in-law was killed in Vietnam, and he was trained out here in San Diego. He was with the Seawolves. He was a pilot with the Seawolves, and that was the only Navy fighter helicopter squadron, which the Navy didn't even admit they had till about 10 years ago. So unfortunately, he was killed in Vietnam, but my sister was pregnant with my niece at the time, and she knew San Diego because Jimmy was taught what to do here with the SEALs and the Seawolves. So we came to San Diego. And at the time, I had to go to Florida, and I didn't want to do that, leave my dad. So I passed on signing with them. And then I played 1 year of college up here at Grossmont College. I played baseball and football. And unfortunately, in that time, then my mom got sick. My mom passed away too. But I wound up breaking my ankle. And so severely, I broke it, dislocated it, a compound fracture. And I lost the quick twitch reflex in my ankle. So what made me a power hitting shortstop, third baseman, I didn't quite have that extra twitch and speed anymore. So there went the baseball career, but I still love baseball, my God. So then I played music. Things happen for a reason.
So who do you root for? Are you a Padres fan, considering it you're down there in San Diego?
You know, I root for them because we live here, but I grew up a Yankees fan. Okay. So I have to root for the Yankees. But I come by it naturally. And sure, I have to hate teams like the Red Sox, but I still respect them because it's what's good in baseball. Like my sons will question me sometimes going, you know, are you bummed when people go, Yankees suck? I say no, because people don't come up and say the Mariners suck or they don't say the Pirates suck. It's a command of respect too.
Well,
there are certain teams that I hate, but I respect them. I hate the Red Sox, but I respect them because of all their history. So I'm a Yankees fan. I still got to root for them. I took my oldest son to the 86 World Series. No, 98. I want to say 80s. 98 when the Yanks swept it here. We were game four. And my wife is just coming home. That's why the dogs are all going crazy here too. My wife, Dawn, who's trying to be quiet. But I got to root for the Yankees. That's who I grew up on. I mean, I can go up and down. My sons are named Gehrig after Lou and Casey after Stengel. So
very good. Very good.
I grew up at the old Yankee Stadium.
Yeah. Well, I was going to piggyback off of what you said. Well, no one says the Mariners suck. Wayne and I are diehard Mariner fans, and we're the ones who say the Mariners suck. So I get it.
Yeah. But man, I got my fingers crossed for you this year. You're like right there.
We're so close, but yet the last week has just been terrible. So, we'll see.
Yeah, well, you know, I've got a gut feeling though. You know, certain teams were choking, and like Texas was choking, and they're coming back. Yeah.
Giants are choking.
Yeah, the Giants are choking, but yeah. I got my fingers crossed for you because I want to see the teams like, you know, I want to see Seattle and Baltimore do well, teams like that.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. All right, Phil, anything else that we missed?
I can't think of anything. There was some more stories that I didn't even hear when we were talking that one day that we were together. It's, you know, we're sitting here and he's telling these stories and we're documenting these stories for others to hear. Which I think that's very important. That's what's important with this particular podcast. You know, I've known Chris for about maybe 14 years now. And I remember my son being 4 years old and he's almost 16. And that's my introduction to him. And from that point on, I mean, it's been like, it's been part of the family type of thing, which, you know, and, you know, especially, you know, bringing in my daughter too as well. I mean, there was times when we go see them and they come, you know, tell the kids, come up on stage. We'll sing Happy Boy together. You know, those are the things that really,
that's how you make a fan.
Oh yeah. And you know, it's something and he listened to his stories and his history and what he's been, involved with. That's a story that needs to be shared, I think.
Yeah.
You know, and because, you know, we don't know all this stuff. My middle brother was in the band in the late 80s, and he was stuck in trying to get those big record deals. And I didn't understand why he didn't get it. And now I understand what he went through and his, and even with the beef farmers, what happened with them, why you want to keep your stuff, why you want to produce your own stuff, and, you know, why, you know, go independent, basically. That makes sense.
Yeah. It's an unusual business. And just kind of to echo a little bit what Phil was saying, we're so thrilled to be able to have our friends come out. And I joke with people, but I fully mean it. We get to take our friends to work with us and we drink on the job. So we have a wonderful gig. And, you know, these people are whatever. They're coming out either getting babysitters or they're changing their days off to come see you. My God. And people will just be so thankful. Don't thank me. We're thanking you for coming to see us. And sure, let's have you up on stage or let's sign this for you or hang out with us. We're so lucky to still be doing this and to have you guys still come out and value listening to us. I mean, it's just I'm thrilled to be able to do it. And I'm shocked when people just turn into rock stars or movie stars and what they turn into. We just it's not in our cloth. We didn't grow up that way. We weren't taught to be like that. We just love people, and we're so lucky to have our friends come out and see us.
Very cool. Well, last question for you. So if we were to have done our usual format where the guest talks about, you know, an important record for them, a favorite record of theirs, what record means the most to you, or what are some of the records that mean the most to you?
Naturally, I should go back to things like early Elvis records, things like that, that I learned about from my parents and my two sisters and brother. Yet people like Elvis turned me on to really this rock and roll. But I think there's been so many along the way, whether it's early rock and roll, early blues, or country, British Invasion, that lately, again, I've been kind of hooked on that Willie DeVille, Mink DeVille, who I was talking about with my T-shirt here that you can't see, but we can talk about, where here's a guy I've been waiting for a documentary to come out on him.
The shape you're in, finger on your eyebrow and left hand on your hip, thinking that you're such a lady killer, think you're so slick. Well, all right.
And he's an interesting guy. Everybody thought he was one of those New York City Puerto Rican guys. He was actually a Jewish kid from Stamford, Connecticut. He came up with the name Willie DeVille or Mink DeVille, and he just grew into this, oh, you know, kind of the greasy purple shirt, iridescent suit, sharkskin suit, pointed toe shoes that, and that's the way I dress. That's the way I grew up looking like that because I learned about it from all the kids in the neighborhood. So my friends were all just unique. I can't stop and say like, well, I grew up in a whatever neighborhood. There was everybody of a different flavor, different color. And with that came along with their taste in music and their taste in food and the way they dressed. So I love that Mink or Willie DeVille adopted this kind of greasy Puerto Rican, if anything, kind of the West Side Story look. But then he adapted as time went on. He had like a 20 or 30 year long battle with heroin, which he finally kind of beat, but left him with different deficits along the way. Wind up passing due to cancer of the pancreas, but along the way he had hepatitis C. And while he was being treated for that, they discovered the cancer of the pancreas. Mm. He was a chain smoker. He couldn't give that up. But he eventually moved down to New Orleans and he started hanging out with guys like Doc Pomus, another Brill building songwriter kind of guy, okay. Dr. John. He spent a lot of time in Europe where he would play in Berlin and hang out in Paris. And then near the end, he moved to the Southwest and he was living in New Mexico, and he was discovering he did have some American Indian roots, where he was shaving the sides of his hair, and he was in a mohawk, and he was dressing in, you know, different animal skins. So he went through different facets of different characters, but I think I'm most fascinated with his street smart urban decay New York 70s, 80s, because that's kind of how I grew up. So I just think he's a guy that came up with interesting material. He invented his characters, and he really played the characters. He had the great gold tooth and the pencil-thin mustache, which, oh, Phil didn't see me. I grew a pencil-thin mustache last Wednesday that I used through a show on Sunday that I took off this morning, which I impressed myself how quick that came in and how good that looked. It was the Errol Flynn, David Niven, a little bit of Mink DeVille, a Willie DeVille look. But I got rid of it this morning. It's just too hard to keep. So I had that one. But I'd have to say, yeah, if any of the listeners here, they don't know much about Willie DeVille or the band Mink DeVille. Later on, you know, he won an Academy Award for one of his songs he did with Mark Knopfler for The Princess Bride. He's worth investigating.
Yeah, very good.
Fun stuff.
All right. Chris, this has been a pleasure. Thanks for hanging out with us.
Appreciate you guys having me on.
Yeah, this was a lot of fun. Phil, did we do it?
Yes, sir.
Okay. All right.
Yep.
All right.
Yeah, I did. I'm very pleased, and it means a lot just to, you know, again, he's been a friend for about 14 years with myself and my family, and it just, the stories, I knew he had a story to tell, and I wanted to make sure that that story was shared. And, you know, because I remember, you know, when we did the Beat Farmers podcast, that episode, nobody knew about the Beat Farmers and what's behind it and all that stuff. And I think it's important to share stories of those individuals that were not on record covers, not, you know, touring, you know, the world and things like that, but they have a story to tell.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, I mean, I think that's important for me too. So,
yeah. All right, cool. Thanks, everyone.
Hey, thank you, fellas.
All right.
Be well.
All right.
Thank you.
Meet you, Chris.
Baby, by my side.